We begin, however, and I'm very pleased to have as our first guest tonight, veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, editor of Too Much, a weekly newsletter on excess and inequality, and a contributor to the weekly column Other Words. And Sam is also author of his most recent book, titled The Rich Don't Always Win, a hopeful title. And right now, thanks for making time to come on our program, Sam. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
I invited you to come on this evening, Sam, because many of our listeners are aware, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times in their new Upshot feature. It was published on April 22nd, and the piece was titled, "The American Middle Class is No Longer the World's Richest." Now, that title, I guess, by itself is not surprising, given the fact that most Americans are very much aware of the trend toward greater inequality in the country. But what was interesting about this particular piece was that it presented evidence concluding that America's middle class, as compared to other industrialized nations, particularly Canada and Europe, have seen considerably larger raises over the last 30 years than their American counterparts. And there's a lot to talk about this evening about inequality. It's an important topic for us to talk about as much as we can, because we have to come up with some solutions. But I thought initially, Sam, I'd ask for your opinion and your view as to the importance of this group of statistics presented in this particular article.
Well, this is a very important set of statistics, because it does give us a comparative international view, and we really don't see too many of those comparative international views here in the United States. The statistical work for the Times article was done by the Luxembourg Income Study, which is an international consortium of social scientists, and they actually compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges across the developed world and help us see who's making what in different countries. They use the concept of disposable income. So they take the market income, the income people make from their paychecks and other sources of income. They subtract out taxes and they add in government benefits like unemployment insurance or Social Security, things like that. So what they end up with is what they call disposable income. And when you look at disposable income around the world, around the developed world, you see that it's been an incredibly lousy century so far for average Americans. Since the year 2000, disposable income in the United States has barely nudged at all. It's only up 0.3%. In other countries, by comparison, the increase is much, much higher. So you look at Spain. Spain we now see as a basket case, with all sorts of economic trouble. But yet in Spain, they've had a disposable income increase of 4.1%, well over 10 times the U.S. increase. In Italy, another country that's doing very poorly economically, the increase has been 8%. In the Netherlands, 14%. In Canada, our neighbors to the north, they've seen a 20% increase in disposable household income since the year 2000. Again, we've seen 0.3%. So looking across the world, the developed world, our peer nations, we're really doing, average people in the United States are really doing much, much worse than people elsewhere.
Thanks for that wrap on some of those stats, Sam. You know, there are a lot of people out there that probably don't understand the forces that contribute to inequality in this country. But by looking at the public policies of these other industrialized nations around the world and what they do different from the United States that contributes to less inequality than we have here, what can we learn? Because it's just clear, I think once you understand the dynamics that contribute to inequality, you understand it's not an accident. It's not the result of the accidental forces of nature.
No, it's not an accident at all. And in fact, I think the best comparison to make is the comparison within the United States. That is, the comparison between the United States today and where we were in the middle of the 20th century when when we were, became the the first nation in the world to create a mass middle class. And at that time, that mass middle class was built on two main factors. One, we had a strong labor movement in the United States. Over one out of every three workers carried a union card, and because of that, unions set the labor market pace, and even non-union workers ended up getting union-level wages because unions were so prevalent throughout the economy. Right now, less than 7% of U.S. workers hold union cards. Over vast swatches of the country, the labor movement and collective bargaining have essentially disappeared. So what we have is that the treasure that the United States economy is generating every year is flowing into the pockets of people at the top and not average Americans. And that's a prime source of the inequality that we're facing. Back in the middle of the 20th century, we also had a strong progressive tax system that limited inequities from the operations of the market. Income over $400,000 in the 1950s faced a 91% top tax rate. Now it's 39.6% for that same income. So, but just by letting our progressive tax system atrophy, just by tolerating the assault on unions that we've seen over the past 50 and 60 years, we've changed the dynamics of income and wealth distribution in the United States, and other countries have not gone through that process to anywhere near the extent that we have here in the United States.
Sam, how important are factors like globalization, outsourcing of manufacturing to cheap labor markets in China, Vietnam, and other places around the world, as well as automation and the loss of jobs through new technologies?
Well, tackle the first one, the second one first. Automation has been a phenomenon throughout the past century here in the United States, and we became more equal in the middle of the 20th century, despite all sorts of technological gains that we were seeing then. So automation in and of itself doesn't determine how unequal a country has been, and indeed our peer nations elsewhere in the developed world are living through the same automation that we are, and yet don't have the stark, staggering inequality, the top-heavy distribution of income and wealth that we have in the United States. Globalization definitely plays a major factor here. Plays a major factor because companies here have been able to flee to countries with an even weaker union labor movement than we have here in the United States, and that creates all sorts of problems, of course, for us here.
We're speaking with labor journalist Sam Pizzigatti. He's author of the book, The Rich Don't Always Win, and we're talking about inequality in the United States in a feature that put together some statistics in the New York Times that the headline was, "The American Middle Class is No Longer the Richest in the World." And Sam, I wanted to ask you about redistribution. Tell us about European nations and their policies relating to redistribution of wealth and how that has sort of minimized the gross inequality that we see here in the United States.
Well, they have all sorts of policies. One in most other major mature developed nations, there is national collective bargaining that sets basic wage rates in various industries, and this can be very strong, so strong that some countries don't even have a minimum wage because they don't need it, because the national collective bargaining sets such a high standard for the labor force. Other countries also provide much more in the way of social supports for people. So if a young couple has a baby, throughout Scandinavia, both the father and the mother get paid leave to take care of the child. And many of our peer developed nations universities are free or very, very low cost, so students don't graduate with mountains of student debt. People in other countries also enjoy much more leisure, 5 and 6 weeks of mandatory vacation on the job, whereas in the United States there is no mandatory vacation, and most workers feel fortunate if they get 2 weeks of paid vacation leave a year. There are things like subsidized child care in other nations, again, where people don't have to go into debt to take basic care of their families. So if you go up and down the rhythm of daily life, you see all sorts of supports for people, for average people in other developed nations. We just don't have those supports here.
Sam, I also wanted to ask you, I guess the million-dollar question here, the trillion-dollar question, what are some of the policy prescriptions that you would advise the country take a serious look at, debate, and a vote on in terms of the capacity to reverse economic disparity in this country? What are the ones that you think are the most important?
Well, there are a number of things, but I would say that the very first thing we need to do is we need to stop subsidizing inequality with our tax dollars, and that's exactly what we're doing right now. Every major corporation in the United States depends on government contracts and government tax subsidies of various support, whether you're talking about Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor, or General Motors or Apple computers. Everybody has, every major corporation has its hand in the till in one way or another. And yet these same corporations that are taking our tax dollars are paying their chief executives at 200, 300, 400, 500 and more times what average workers are receiving. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, average CEOs only made 30 times more than their workers are making. So one thing that we're talking about, the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, is that we should tie government procurement and government tax breaks to corporate pay policies. And if a corporation is paying its top executives hundreds of times more than its average workers are receiving, that corporation should not be able to receive a government contract. That corporation should not be able to receive a government tax break. There are other things that we can do along that line. In California right now, the state of California, there's legislation pending that would tax corporations that have a high ratio between CEO and worker pay at a higher level than corporations that have a modest differential between CEO and worker pay. And these are the sorts of steps I think we need to start thinking about. At the same time, we need to do the things that we know work from the past. We need to enable unions to organize and change the labor rules that benefit management so overwhelmingly today. And of course, we need to reinstitute a strong progressive tax system where people of great wealth pay a higher share of their income in taxes than people of modest means.
Sam, President Obama is certainly part of the buzz about the discussions on inequality since the Occupy movement in New York City and Zuccotti Park back in September 2011 really put that topic front and center before the public. President Obama has talked a lot about raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. He hasn't been successful at the federal level because the House is blocking any movement on that. But there are states that are moving towards that $10.10 goal. How much of a difference does a minimum wage make here in terms of reversing the trend toward inequality and helping the endangered species of the middle class in this country?
Well, the minimum wage is very important. The purchasing power of today's minimum wage is substantially below the purchasing power of the minimum wage in the 1960s. And moving to $10.10 an hour would definitely be a step forward, but it's not nearly enough. A worker making $10.10 an hour working full time would still not be able to take a family of three out of poverty. So we need to do better. And in some places, they're thinking about doing better. In the city of Seattle right now, there's a major movement supported by the mayor to establish a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And that's the sort of bold move that we really need in the United States.
We're speaking with veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzigatti. He's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and editor of Too Much, a weekly newsletter on excess and inequality. And he's the author of the book, The Rich Don't Always Win. We're talking about inequality in the United States. And Sam, I wanted to ask you about public perception here.
Mm-hmm.
I read about a recent Gallup poll that found that upwards of 67% of Americans are dissatisfied with the nation's current wealth and income distribution. That's quite high. But when it comes to the prescriptions you're talking about to reverse inequality, it seems that when people vote in elections, they don't necessarily vote for the politicians that are going to make those changes. In fact, they vote for folks who are very happy with the status quo, bankrolled by large moguls like the Koch brothers and the like. And to many people, it seems like our political system is broken, which has led to our economic system to be failing.
That's right. I agree wholeheartedly with that observation that our political system is broken. Our democracy has become, in effect, a plutocracy. We're a place where the rich rule. That doesn't mean that the rich always get their way in every public policy dispute that comes by, but it does mean that they largely define the agenda. You hear a lot of people talk about gridlock in Washington, how hard it is to get anything done. Well, it certainly is hard to get anything done that benefits average working people. But when it comes to something that benefits the wealthy, the system seems to move with great dispatch. And that's plutocracy, and that's what we have in the United States today, and it just makes our inequality even worse.
And it seems that the Republicans have been quite successful in playing the culture wars to pit white against black and to really sort of place the context of government policies and programs, in the takers versus makers pattern. And that was certainly something that Mitt Romney emphasized in his 2012 campaign. And it seems like you have a lot of people in the country perceiving government programs as benefiting the other, you know, those people, the people who aren't like me. And although there's changing demographic in the country, it's, and I wanted to get your take on this. You think the fact that these racial polarization in the country has contributed to our inequality and the gridlock or the kind of obstacles we find in our politics?
Well, it certainly has, and privileged elites in the United States have been playing the race card, literally for centuries here in the United States. But I think it's important to keep in mind that we've been able to overcome that in the past. In the middle of the 20th century, we were able to overcome that racial divide and forge a much more equal United States where people of all races were able to advance economically in a very, very rapid fashion. We went from a nation that was two-thirds poor before 1940 to a nation that was two-thirds middle class in the 1950s and 60s. That was a tremendous achievement, and it came about because we were able to overcome the divisions that kept average people in the United States apart. So if we did that once, we can do it again.
Oh, well, that's an optimistic note, just like the title of your book, The Rich Don't Always Win.
That's right.
It's probably not fair to do this, but I wanted to get your quick take, and I look forward to talking to you about this topic again, and that is the French economist Thomas Piketty's
yes.
best-selling new book,
yes.
Capital in the 21st Century,
yes.
which I have it right, argues that unfettered capitalism inevitably leads to extreme income inequality. So the die is cast, according to this guy, and a lot of people are paying attention to his thesis. What are your thoughts on Piketty and his book?
Well, I've been following the work of Thomas Piketty for the past dozen years. He's worked with his colleague Manuel Saez at the University of California, Berkeley, over that time, and he and Saez have revolutionized our statistical understanding of inequality. They've been able to use tax records to focus in on the share of income going not just to the top 1%, but to the top 0.1% and the top 0.01%, and that's been incredibly. Their work has been incredibly illuminating. I think Piketty's new book is a major, major, important effort that's going to have an incredibly positive that could have an incredibly positive impact on the debate over inequality in the United States. But what's happening now is that the brilliance of this book is so self-evident that different people are trying to claim it as their own. So there is a big debate emerging now on the meaning of the Piketty book, and there are lots of people who want to dumb down Piketty and to tame the message of his book. And I think that struggle over who gets to define what Piketty is actually talking about, what this book actually signifies, is going to be very important over the next 6 months.
Well, we're out of time. Sam, I appreciate your contributing to our better understanding of inequality today, and would love to have you back to talk more about these issues. But how can our listeners read your columns at the Too Much newsletter?
Well, if people just Google Too Much, you'll come straight to the Too Much page, and folks can sign up to receive our weekly newsletter, and we'd love to have them aboard.
So that's T-O-O Much. We got
yes.
it. Okay. Thanks so much for making time for us. Appreciate it, Sam.
Thank you.
Good night. And that's Sam Pizzicati, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and editor of the Too Much Weekly newsletter and a contributor to the weekly column, Other Words.